Gordon Reed in the kitchen of their home in South Bend, Washington. Gordon stabbed Enola 17 times with the bread knife in front of 3 of their 4 young children. The baby was sleeping. In 2001, my friend and co-author Rita Nakashima Brock and I published the book Bruce just told you about, Proverbs of Ashes, Violence, Redemptive Suffering, and the Search for What Saves Us. In that book, we told stories from our lives of people, from our own lives and from the lives of people we have known, in order to unmask the ways Christian doctrines about the crucifixion of Jesus have functioned to sanction physical and sexual abuse, violence, homophobia, and war. The story of Enola's murder opens the book. Enola had tried to escape her abusive husband. She'd sought shelter in the home of the local United Methodist minister, my friend, the Reverend Pat Simpson. Pat and other women in the community had supported Enola when she brought charges of domestic abuse against Gordon, and they accompanied her to court when she testified against him. When he got out of jail, Enola had to decide what to do. She let him come home. Pat said Enola was struggling to keep her family together, and she believed, as do many Christian women, that her own suffering and pain was a cross to bear, and that a truly loving person would put aside her own need for the sake of the family. Gordon killed her. He is the one responsible for her death. But Pat and I couldn't help feeling that Christian theological ideas had been an accomplice in her death. Christianity had taught Enola that love is willing to bear any amount of abuse. It had taught Pat and me the same things. We grieved Enola's death and began a long theological conversation about the ideas that had made it hard for her to choose life, to protect her own life, and to protect her children's lives. In honor of Enola, Pat remembered all the small things that were signs of Enola's efforts at resistance. Pat helped see to it that Enola was buried wearing her favorite earrings in her pierced ears because she had pierced her ears in defiance of Gordon's objections. And Pat planted nasturtiums in her memory, flowers that are tough and persistent, yet yielding wonderful, colorful blossoms in harsh circumstances. Rita and I wrote Proverbs of Ashes to call our own Christian heritage to account for the harm perpetrated by its atonement doctrines. We critique and reject every formulation of the idea that Jesus' crucifixion is an acceptable image for how God saves the world, or a good model for love. After publishing Proverbs, we began a new quest. We wanted to offer Christians and other people of faith an alternative religious vision, one that was centered on something different than violent death. In the course of our research, we stumbled across an interesting fact buried in a footnote in a scholarly journal. One moral of this story is always read the footnotes. This footnote told us that Jesus' crucifixion was not depicted for the first 1,000 years of Christian art. It took Jesus 1,000 years to die. Images of his corpse did not appear in churches until the 10th century. Initially, Rita and I didn't believe this could be true. Surely the art historians were wrong. The crucified Christ was too important to Western Christianity. How could it be that images of Jesus' suffering and death were absent from early churches? We had to see for ourselves and consider what this might mean. So in July of 2002, Rita and I set off on a pilgrimage to the Mediterranean world in search of the dead body of Jesus. We began in Rome, descending from the blaze of the summer sun into the catacombs, where underground tunnels and tombs are carved into soft tufa rock. The earliest surviving Christian art is painted onto the plaster-lined walls or carved into marble sarcophagi as memorials to the interred. In the cool, dimly lit caverns, we saw a variety of biblical images. Many of them suggested rescue from danger. For example, Abraham and Isaac stood side by side in prayer with a ram bound next to them. Jonah, the recalcitrant prophet who was swallowed and coughed up by the sea monster, was one of the most popular images in early Christian art, and he's always shown reclining peacefully beneath the shade of his vine. Daniel stood alive and well between two pacified lions. Other images suggested baptism and healing, such as the Samaritan woman drawing water from the well, John the Baptist dousing Jesus, depicted as a child, and Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. Jesus also appeared as a shepherd carrying a lamb on his shoulders in the same iconography as Orpheus, the god of music and of the underworld. We could not find a dead Jesus, not even one. Emerging from the underworld, we traipsed the dusty streets of the city to continue our investigation of the mystery of the missing corpse. Some art historians said there was a crucifixion carved on the doors of St. Sabina Church, so we trudged up the hill from the Tiber to see it late one sweltering afternoon. Under the church's covered entrance were two 1,500-year-old cypress doors with 32 scenes from the Bible. Each carved relief panel is about 18 by 12 inches. Among them, we were told, we would find one of the oldest known representations of the crucifixion, created around 425. We spotted the purported crucifixion in the far upper left-hand corner. There we saw three robust, bearded men facing forward, a large central figure flanked by two smaller ones. They wore loincloths and stood firmly, unwounded and unbowed. They raised their stout, strong arms to the side, elbows slightly bent, hands shoulder high. We'd seen this familiar stance in the catacombs. Historians call it the orant, the ancient position for prayer, a posture of both strength and openness, as if the arms were ready to embrace the viewer or receive the gifts of the Holy Spirit. The figure's eyes were wide open, meeting the eyes of the viewer. This image, we realized, depicted resurrection. Jesus was not suffering in agony on the cross. Death had no power over him. He was alive. From Rome, we went to Istanbul and then on to a remote part of northeastern Turkey where the crumbling remains of 9th to 11th century monastery churches could be found high up on mountains. We couldn't find the dead body of Jesus there either. It was just as the Gospels said, the angel had said to the women looking for Jesus at his tomb. Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He most certainly was not. Our pilgrimage made us realize that for first millennium Christians, the crucifixion of Jesus was not a key to meaning, not an image of devotion, not a ritual symbol of faith for the Christians who worshiped among the church's glittering mosaics. The Christ they saw was the incarnate, risen Christ, the child of baptism, the healer of the sick, the teacher of his friends, and the one who defeated death and transfigured the world with the spirit of life. After it registered on us that the crucifixion was absent, we began to pay attention to what was present in early Christian art. We found a clue in an arresting image in an unlikely place, the most important church in Western Christendom and still the cathedra, the seat of the Bishop of Rome, San Giovanni in Laterano. We arrived at San Giovanni during Mass, which was conducted from a high Baroque altar at the top of the transept steps, residue to our eyes of one of the more incongruent restorations of the 17th century. The altar displayed a huge triptych painting with the crucifixion in the center, and it completely hid the apse, the curved apse that was behind it. We walked quietly down the right aisle, tiptoed up the transept steps, ignored the velvet rope blocking further progress, and snuck behind the altar. When we spotted the apse, we gasped in wonder. At the top of its curve, a bust of Jesus gazed down, serious and dignified. His golden nimbus outlined his countenance against a dark blue background strewn with red and blue clouds. A single seraph hovered directly above him, upside down, its wings spread out in shelter. Below this upper blue crescent of sky, the apse sparkled in gold like the light of a dawn sky. Immediately below Jesus' bust, a dove emerged, head down. From its beak, a pale stream of water poured downward. Can you hear the rain? Below the dove was a golden segmented cross with a large jewel in the center of each segment. The stream of water fell behind the cross, slowly widening until it formed a translucent pool around its base. In the center of the cross was an oval medallion. It showed Jesus standing in water, his head slightly bowed, while John the Baptist on the shore poured water over his head. At the base of the cross, where the water pooled, two deer, one on either side, stood atop a hill of grass and flowers, their heads bent to drink from the water. As a deer longs for the water brooks, so longs my heart for thee, O God. Below the pool, four rivers flowed out from the tree like roots, curving left and right, and the rivers were carefully labeled Pishon, Gihon, Tigris, and Euphrates, the rivers of paradise in Genesis 2. At the base of the entire apse, the oldest section of the mosaic, dating from the 4th century, showed a whole wide river flowing across the curved base, and the four little rivers flowed into the big river, and it was also carefully labeled Jordan. There were lush meadows along the river's bank, filled with birds and flowers, and in the river itself, swans paddled serenely in pairs, a couple of cherubs fished from a boat, one cherub rode on a swan, another swam in the waves, and a fifth windsurfed across them with a little boat with a sail. This image permeated our consciousness until we understood at last that we stood in paradise. The image depicted a vision found in a popular 3rd century Christian text called the Apocalypse of Paul. Here's the text. I entered paradise and saw the beginning of waters, and the angel beckoned me. And when I had gone inside, I saw a tree planted from whose roots water flowed out. And from this was the beginning of the four rivers. And the Spirit of God rested upon that tree. And when the Spirit blew, the waters flowed forth. And I said, "My Lord, is it this tree itself which makes the waters flow?" And he said to me, "From the beginning, before the heavens and earth appeared, the Spirit has been resting upon this tree. Wherefore, whenever the Spirit blows, the waters flow forth from the tree." Unquote. As we looked at other early church interiors, we began to see more clearly how each captured dimensions of paradise. In the spaces, scenes of a cosmos of stars in midnight skies, we saw golden sunlight, sparkling seas teeming with fish, exuberant fauna, and verdant meadows lush with flowers and fruit trees. These images placed Christians in a lush visual environment. Punctuating these scenes were images of the great cloud of witnesses, many dressed in purple robes of nobility. Others wore white robes of baptism as brides of Christ. They wore or carried wedding wreaths. Many apse images in the surviving churches from the 4th to 7th centuries show exactly the four rivers flowing from a lamb, a blue globe, or a golden cross. To understand these images better, Rita and I began to re-study the rituals of baptism and Eucharist performed in these spaces, and to reconsider early Christian commentaries on Genesis, read through the lens of the visual world of Christian teachers, such as Ambrose and Augustine. We wanted to re-encounter the text with the visual world as a primary context in which to read the texts. To our surprise and delight, we discovered that early Christian paradise was something other than heaven or the afterlife. In the early church, paradise first and foremost was this world, blessed and permeated by the Spirit of God. Images of it in Rome and Ravenna captured the craggy, scruffy pastoral landscapes, the orchards, the clear night skies, and the teeming waters of the Mediterranean world, as if they were lit up by a power from within. Like the breathing of a human body, the images said God blessed the earth with the breath of spirit. It permeated the entire cosmos, filling it with creativity and abundant life. The meaning of paradise, earthly paradise, for early Christians is clearly spelled out in the writings of the 4th century Saint Ephrem of Syria, ancient Christianity's most popular poet, the Rumi of his era. Ephrem's extensive reflections on paradise are recorded in his Hymns on Paradise, a book comprised of 15 long poems, more than 1,000 lines altogether on paradise. In these poems, Ephrem speaks of paradise as a landscape that calls humanity to live ethical, just, and joyous lives, and to journey towards union with God. He pictures paradise as a great cosmic mountain that encompasses the earth and the ocean. He taught that the baptized enter paradise now and live within the embrace of this mountain. In the church, humanity gained access to paradise and its inebriating pleasures. Here's one of my favorite passages from Ephrem. And those of you who heard the lecture yesterday already heard this. It's worth hearing again. Ephrem writes, "Paradise surrounds the limbs with its many delights, the eyes with its handiwork, the hearing with its sounds, the mouth and nostrils with its tastes and scents. Paradise raised me up as I perceived it. It enriched me as I meditated upon it. I swam around in its magnificent waves. I became so drunk with its fragrance that I forgot all my sins." Ephrem's joy in paradise stands in contrast to the many difficulties his Christian communities faced under two powerful empires. He lived in the contested borderlands between the Persian and the Roman empires. War destroyed his city, and he and many became refugees fleeing violence. His existence was perhaps not unlike those living today in Palestinian refugee camps or among the refugees in Darfur fleeing genocide. Living among his refugee community, Ephraim organized food distribution and set up hospitals to care for the sick. He enlisted the cooperation of the healthy to maintain the community and extend the church's care. His poetry and hymns on paradise show us that he encouraged those under his care to savor the mystery of the goodness of this life until their last breath. Here are some more of his lines. The breath that wafts from some blessed corner of paradise gives sweetness to the bitterness of this region. It tempers the curse on this earth of ours. That garden is the life breath of this diseased world. As Rita and I delved deeper into our study of paradise, as it was understood by early Christians, we discovered that spiritual disciplines and rituals were essential. Christians received intense training to initiate them into paradise in this life. Through baptism, Christians learn to resist the forces of sin and evil and become wise about how good and evil work in the world, especially the oppressive powers of empires. The baptized were symbolically immersed in the rivers of paradise and were reborn as citizens of paradise, imbued with divine powers and capacities which they were to use for good. For early Christians, the truth that Jesus revealed was that we are living now in paradise as empowered and dignified beings in a cosmos that is abundant and good despite its dangers and tragedies. Our calling is to live our lives with reverence, self-respect, wisdom, and ethical courage that manifest the truth of who we are, whose we are, and where we are. As the paradise of early Christianity entered our vision and seeped into our consciousness, crucifixion-centered Christianity began to seem increasingly strange to us. What happened to the understanding of this world as paradise? When and why did Christianity shift to an obsession with atoning death and redemption through violence and relegate paradise to a distant afterlife, a realm lost at the beginning of time? Like detectives in search of a murder victim, we followed a trail of clues that led us finally to a body. We found the corpse of Jesus for the first time at a considerable distance from the Mediterranean world, in the forests of the far north of Europe, where the Rhine wends its way from the Alps to the North Sea. Saxon artists carved the first crucifixions, three-dimensional life-size wooden figures, in the 10th century. Their 9th century ancestors were forced by Charlemagne's soldiers to be baptized at the point of the sword, so that Latin Christianity came to them accompanied by death. The oldest crucifix to survive, the Giro Cross, was created around 965 and can still be seen in the cathedral in Cologne, Germany. It shows Jesus' body nearly naked, twisted in torment on the cross, his head slumped, his face drawn in agony, his eyes closed, his mouth gaping open in death. The emergence of crucifixion imagery expelled paradise from this world and replaced it with the idea that paradise could only be entered after death and violence could help get you there. The decisive turning point came in 1095 when Pope Urban II called the First Crusade. Up until Urban's time, Christians regarded violence as a sin. War could be waged in self-defense or to right an injustice, but war was always a last resort, and even if the cause was just, those who participated in war committed a sin and were required to do penance to heal their souls. But with the call of the First Crusade, this changed. Urban declared that war was not only just, it was a form of serving God, an act of love for one's blood kin. Through killing Jews and Muslims, Urban declared crusaders would receive forgiveness for all their sins and would be assured of a place in paradise. War, in short, became the primary form of penitential action. And penance was what released you from eternal damnation into heaven. Beginning with the First Crusade, the crucifixion of Jesus became the central image for Christian worship. Anselm of Canterbury, Pope Urban's friend, formulated an explicit theology of atonement, proposing that God became human in Jesus in order to die on the cross to pay God back for humanity's sins. Anselm described Jesus' death as a pleasing gift to God. And if you have read Cur Deus Homo, Anselm's text, you might notice that there is not a single reference in the treatise to the resurrection. Anselm's theology supported the Crusades. Soldiers were called to imitate Christ by offering themselves to be sacrificed and give their life as gift of death, just as Jesus had. To kill or to be killed for God became the fastest route to paradise. The communion meal became a reenactment of the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. His death, not his birth, life, healings, and teachings, became the doorway to salvation. With the advent of crucifixion-centered theologies, paradise was no longer tasted and felt as a spiritual realm to be entered in this life. It was postponed to the hereafter, or secularized as a land to be conquered. When Christopher Columbus set sail, he records in his journal that he was looking for paradise, for its fabled gold and jewels. Colonization, with its exploitation of peoples and lands, evolved from the loss of paradise. So did the Atlantic slave trade, which began in the 15th century as a crusading activity sanctioned by the Pope to capture and supposedly save from infidelity Africans, many of whom were Muslims, by bringing them into Christian culture for their redemption. The redemptive pathway for Africans, like that of Jesus, the church believed, was through humiliation, whipping, and bondage. When crucifixion became the image of salvation, acts of terror and violence received divine sanction. Our study of this history has given Rita and me a new perspective, which we offer in our book, Saving Paradise. Crucifixion-centered theology that valorizes violence as redemptive is not the only theological option in Christian tradition. The paradise tradition places abundant life at the center of religious imagination and offers hope now that a different Christianity is possible, rooted in orthodox teachings and practices of the church. In fact, crucifixion-centered theology appears to be a tragic wrong turn taken by Western Christianity in Christianity's second millennium, a turn that intricately connected Christianity with the strategies of empire. This is a turn we need to recover from. What we need now is a religious perspective that does not locate salvation in a future endpoint in time, a transcendent realm, or a zone after death, and that does not usher us into salvation through violence. Paradise is not withheld, closed, or removed from us. Realizing this requires us to let go of the notion that paradise is life without struggle, life free from wrestling with legacies of injustice or current forces of evil. After all, remember, in the story of the garden, evil was present and had to be contended with. Assuredly, we are in a world in which the struggle continues. However, it is also true that we already live on holy ground, in the presence of God, with bodies and souls sanctified by the Spirit's anointing and surrounded by the communion of saints. Our spiritual challenge is to live facing into this reality. Histories of harm are all around us. Current forces of evil operate within and among us, and yet everywhere the Spirit rises in the wind. The rivers of paradise circle the earth. The risen Christ is with us on the road, and the fountain of wisdom springs up from the earth we walk on, from this holy ground. Another religious foundation is possible. It begins when we understand that paradise is already present. We have neither to retrieve it nor to construct it. We have to perceive it and bring our lives and our cultures into accord with it. We re-enter this world as sacred space when we love life fiercely and in the name of love protect the goodness of our intricate web of life in all its manifold forms. We recommit ourselves to this world as holy ground when we remember the fullness of life that is possible through our communities, our life-affirming rituals, and our love of beauty. Thus immersed, we can find ourselves more responsive to and more responsible for life in this world. We can enter heart, soul, mind, and strength into savoring and saving paradise. So, what then are we to make of Jesus' death on the cross? How can Christian theologians claim that the crucifixion is not the center of our faith when, for example, the Gospels devote nearly one-third of their narrative to Jesus' betrayal, arrest, trial, torture, and death? This is an important question, and it led Rita and me to restudy the Passion narratives. Crucifixion was a terror tactic used by the Roman Empire to control subjugated peoples. Jews did not crucify people. Romans did. The Romans crucified runaway slaves and movement leaders who were opposed to Roman occupation. Crucifixion was designed to completely obliterate the person and any memory of the person. Bodies were hung on crosses, legs and arms would be broken, death came slowly, and the dead were left in the open to rot as a sign to warn others. Crucifixion was a shameful way to die. Families of the crucified would not speak of those who'd been killed this way. The whole purpose of crucifixion was to instill silence and fear. The Passion narratives are carefully crafted accounts that counter the effects crucifixion was intended to have. The accounts say Jesus' body was not broken. He was not left to rot. While some ran away in fear, he had friends who did not abandon him. They publicly lifted his body down from the cross, lovingly placed it in a proper burial chamber, and brought spices and ointments to anoint his body. The followers of Jesus, women first of all, remembered his name and dared to speak it out loud. The very act of saying his name, Jesus, defied his crucifiers and their intent. The Passion narratives are texts of resistance. They counter the empire's agenda, and they would not exist without the agency of women. The scholar Kathleen Corley has done the work to make this argument. She writes, quote, Women have in past and present times habitually keened and mourned the dead. Many of these lament traditions, in fact, sustain a poetic genre that goes back thousands of years. As an aside, remember the passages in Jeremiah? Summon the keening women to come that they may raise a lament. The passion narrative, Corley continues, the passion narrative itself could have its roots in the formal context of repeated sung storytelling, which would have preserved the basic details of Jesus' death. I am suggesting, Corley says, that the passion narrative had its origins in a grassroots liturgical context dominated by women and ordinary people. Unquote. Telling the truth about Jesus' crucifixion has abiding importance. To break silence, whenever violence is used to shame, instill fear, fragment human community, control people, or suppress those who advocate for justice, to break silence is life-giving. Just as Jesus in John's gospel stood before Pilate and said, "You have no power over me," the passion narratives defy the powers of crucifixion to silence Jesus' movement. The passion narratives were resurrection acts. They broke silence about the shame and fear that crucifixion instilled. To lament was and is to claim the powers that crucifixion is designed to destroy, to claim the powers of dignity, courage, love, creativity, and truth-telling. In telling his story, Jesus' community remembered his name and claimed the death-defying power of saying that name aloud. Remember, Acts reports the dead could be raised in the name of Jesus. These traditions testify that life is found in surviving the worst a community can imagine, in lamenting the consequences of imperialism, and in holding fast to the core goodness of this world, blessed by divine justice and abundant life. This is the meaning of resurrection and the fulfillment of Christ's promise from the cross. Today, you will be with me in paradise.